Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
Rebecca Danta, Managing Director of Miami Angels.
Rebecca, thanks so much for making time to join us on Ivy Podcast on this Monday morning. Way to kickstart the week, right?
Yeah, excited to start the week off with this.
Awesome. You based here in South Florida?
That's right. Not just South Florida, but Miami. I'm one of those Miamians that don't cross the county line very often.
That's awesome. That's great. A lot of great stuff happening in South Florida these days. From the tech innovation scene. So we'll talk a little bit about that. But before we jump on and talk about Miami Angels and all the great stuff that goes on, tell us a little bit about yourself. You're kind of the thumbnail version of your career.
Yeah, sure thing. So I'm born and raised in Miami, Cuban immigrant parents. I went to University of Florida. So plug for Florida, we have great public universities here. Another reason to move to Florida. Had a wonderful experience there, came back to Miami after college. I was not working in tech and startups at the time, but after a year, I decided I wanted to. And I looked around and there was nothing here for that. So I left to, where do many Miamians go? New York. Then I found a job at General Assembly, kind of happenstance. And it was one of the best things that happened to me because I was there during an incredibly fast growth period. They had just raised their seed round. And I left right before their acquisition in 2017. When I left, I came back to Miami and I said, okay, I want to keep working in startups. It's been a few years. Hopefully things have developed a little more, still not a ton, but a little more than back in 2014. And, I found the job with Miami Angels. So I've been with Miami Angels for 4 years, and we're a local angel investment network. The Miami in the name is that all about 90% of the 130 of our investors are based in South Florida, all accredited investors, but we invest in startups throughout the US, of course, with a special kind of look out for Miami companies. You know, my story is really similar to a lot of others that grew up here, where we felt we had to leave to at least start our career or continue our career. And happy to talk more too in the podcast about how some of these things have changed. And I'm thrilled now about what's happening in our city because I've already seen so many friends move back here. And we really did have a brain drain problem before, and getting better.
Well, that's exciting, and thanks for that overview about your career. Seems very exciting, and going back, you know, coming back to the roots, it's always seems like a great strategy to where you come from. Yes. Tell us a little bit more about the mission and the background of Miami Angels. How did that all get formed, started, and what's the overall vision there?
Yeah, so the story with Miami Angels is that it goes largely hand in hand with the story of what we're seeing in Miami now. It was, the seeds were originally planted for this crazy growth that we're seeing in the Miami tech scene right now back in 2012, 2013. A lot of that was seeded by a local, or actually a national organization headquartered in Miami called the Knight Foundation. The Knight Foundation seeded a lot of the original infrastructure. They seeded with their grant-making work. They seeded the Lab Miami, which was Miami's first co-working space. And there were a dozen others, and Miami Angels was one of them. So they said, we will give you some seed funding to hire your first managing director, which wasn't me, it was Nico Berardi, who's now on our board. And they said, figure out a business model. Here's a couple years worth of funding and let's see what happens. So fast forward to 2021, we've now invested $17 million into over 40 companies. We have 130 members. We're completely sustainable off membership dues. So safe to say it's been a great seed investment for the Knight Foundation.
Well, that's super exciting. And, you know, with so many companies already in the portfolio, to the extent that you can share, what are the most successful ones that you guys have seen go through your guys' organization, your process?
Yeah, so we're on that 7-year mark now. So we're going to start seeing more exits come. The time horizon continues to expand. We expect about 7 to 10 years now. But we actually had our first big exit this year in 2021. Really exciting. It was Nearpod. So we invested in them back in 2015. And they exited in 2021 for $650 million. So that kind of returned the portfolio if we were tracking like a VC fund would. And that's really exciting. And then a handful of others have gone on to raise their Series A's. Also some Series B's in there. Like any venture portfolio, we've had a few go defunct. That's to be expected. But the numbers are all in line with excellent performance of funds. So we're excited about that.
That's great. That's great to hear. So moving on a little bit through, you know, how Miami Angels operates and just in general, the thesis behind the Miami Angels. Tell us a little bit about this. What are, you know, I understand you guys invest throughout the states or maybe even globally. What are some of the most common, I guess, denominators that you observe, especially lately, that, you know, result in the actual investment or the partnership for Miami Angels? What are the different industry segments or particular domain areas that are most interesting, the most exciting?
Yeah. So to tell you a little more about our thesis, we look at what we call early stage companies. Now that's really broad nowadays. So to define it a little more, I would say it's seed stage, which means the product is on the market and they usually have their first few customers, paying customers. And we don't lead rounds because we're an angel network. So we look to syndicate. However, we have a handful of seed stage funds in our group. So it's happened a few times that we will find an entrepreneur that's looking for a lead investor, and then we'll connect them to someone that leads within the group, and then the angels follow on. I always say we're in the business of funding great entrepreneurs, so we don't say, oh, we don't want to talk to you unless you have your lead. And then, so within that stage, we are geography agnostic within the U.S., and we're also industry agnostic. So the category is software, but within software, we will look at any industry. It's really wherever our members have expertise. And with so many members, we have most areas covered.
That makes sense. And you know, I've been angel investing on my own for quite some time now. And very similarly, just really focusing on SaaS businesses and anything that has to do. My own specialty is the B2B sector, mainly because of my, you know, background. But I can definitely relate to there's so much opportunity out there with a lot of the solutions being born out of a particular necessity or a particular problem that a company is trying to solve. So with that extent, kind of further question I have for you is, what are the different trends and ideas that really excite you these days? What is something that you're very passionate about and maybe something that you actually seen in the market from a lot of the founders that are pitching to angel investors?
Yeah, so I'll say as far as industries go, there's a few that we're really honing in on at Miami Angels. And I think part of it has to do with wanting to invest in companies where we already have the infrastructure for companies in those industries to succeed. And, you know, I spoke about the Nearpod exit that was in the ed tech space. And we have quite a few portfolio companies now in the ed tech space. And we want to keep growing that because the more that we invest in our ecosystem of portfolio companies, the more they can also support each other, the more exposure that we have there. But it's not just that. Miami-Dade County is one of the largest public school systems in the U.S. So we actually do have a great backyard for innovative ed tech companies. And then not to mention, which has been kind of the drum has been beaten a lot, but education, largely because of what we've seen in the last year with the pandemic, is really, really about to undergo some major changes. So that's a big area we're looking at. There's also healthcare because of our extremely diverse population, our large hospital systems. And if you look, some of the kind of more underground companies, the ones that haven't been in the news quite so much, but there's been some really successful startups. And I will say this to you, that Miami kind of takes the credit sometimes for some exits that happen in the Broward area. But there are great companies coming out of South Florida in general and Broward as well.
Right. No, absolutely. And there's a lot of great stuff happening in the Broward as well with, I'm sure you've heard that innovation hub that's being built at the Nova Southeastern University campus. You know, a lot goes on in the Boca as well, and north, the Palm Beach area. So that's, you know, just definitely all around exciting times to be in South Florida and being all over the news, especially with everything that goes on. So definitely can relate.
Yeah, and I'll say for those listening, Miami's not for everyone, and you do have a more quieter but still lots of great cultural things happening up in Broward, so that is an option for people to explore as well.
Yep, that's for sure. When we've talked a little bit about the industries and the different insights and trends that you've seen in the market, when it comes to you've mentioned that Miami Angels invest in seed rounds where you do have a working product and some traction from the customer side. What are some of the criteria that you pay attention to when it comes to validating or at least getting some indicators of that early stage product market fit? What are some of the things that you evaluate as a group and that you recommend your angels to actually pay attention to?
Yeah, great point. Because, you know, we hear these terms a lot, like venture investing is about investing in the team and product market fit. But what is that? What are some of those things that we're looking at under the hood? So one is time to get there. Have you been working on this for 10 years or 6 months? Not to say that there's a specific time frame, but we want to see that the timing is right, and that, you know, it's almost every founder pivots in the beginning, and we absolutely support that. We want founders to pivot, but there is negative signaling if you've been working at the same idea for 8 years, for example. So there's that. Then how much money has gone into the product so far? One, it tells us about, as the leader of the company, the capital efficiency and the way that you're allocating your capital. And it also just speaks to the markets, the product market fit, the interest that your customers have in the product. So that's actually always why I encourage people to raise what they need until they can get to that growth stage. You don't want to take on so much at the very, very beginning. Listen, this is venture capital and this is all about growth and putting fuel on the fire, but you want to do it at the right inflection point, because then you get into things like founder dilution and you're just making things more complicated for yourself down the road. The other thing that we look at is month-to-month growth. So when we say that we're investing once the product's on the market and there's customers, that doesn't always mean monetary traction. We just invested in an esports company that's pre-revenue, haven't tried even charging customers yet, but they have an incredible growth rate and they have a lot of very satisfied users, low churn. So that to us is also product market fit. I think it's really important to differentiate too that consumer facing companies like B2C versus B2B, their traction is going to look different at the beginning.
No, that's great. And that makes perfect sense. And as you evaluate from the product growth and the kind of the churn perspective or anything that's over a month or over a year, there's also that whole component of when there are no particular indicators of the product market fit, I'm pretty sure you pay very close attention to the founders and the founding team, sort of that founder market fit, I guess. What are some of the criteria that you drive, you subscribe to when it comes to evaluating the founders? What are some of the indicators that tell you that this has a great potential, even though we haven't seen quite the traction that we want to on the product side?
Yeah, that's a great question. So some people say that they will only invest in kind of seasoned founders or second time founders, or strict rules on we won't invest in couples or things like that. I think that comes from people having been burned in the past, and it happens to every investor, but we don't have anything like that with the founder. To me, it's about just getting to know that person and not putting founders in a box and saying all founders that have this background or like this won't work. One of our most successful portfolio companies, we invested in the founder when he had just graduated college, for example. What's that it factor? One is being a visionary leader, we want to see that not only can you raise capital, but that also tells us, because some founders are only good at raising capital and not executing. We're really looking for that person who can take it to the growth stage. Many times founders leave the company by the time, you know, it's going to make it to a kind of more mature company. It's different skill sets. So we want the person that can take it to that level. And that's like that visionary leader, the person who has the big ideas and can rally others around that vision. So not just the investor, but the team members, being able to attract the best talent is critically important as well. And those things you get in just asking open-ended questions and talking to the founder. The other thing that we look for is, you know, like you heard me say, we really want them to have a strong idea and vision for the product and the company, but we want them to be open to feedback as well. I think something that's really important that we look for is that, you know, that there's integrity, honesty, and those are things that you can figure out too when just asking questions. Are they being truthful? One piece of advice that I always give to founders is if you don't know an answer, it's okay to say, let me get back to you. I actually don't expect that you know every single detail. You might have a CTO. You may not be technical and your CTO may know better something. And we can always tell when you're lying. And I always respect more when someone can own and say, I'm not 100% sure about that. I'll come back to you. So there's a few things.
No, that very last point actually resonates on so many levels with me and some of the criteria that I use to invest in when evaluating founders. I found those that are very successful, you know, those that are clearly able to articulate what are some of the areas that they don't know. And just being exactly. very transparent about this, because that overall clarity of thought, I think for founders is so critical. And when we talk also about that grit and determination, like, can you persevere of 4 years or 5 years of hell and just not being able to, you know, pivoting every week and not generating revenue and finding very creative ways to do that? I think, you know, just it's not for everybody. That's why a lot of accelerators, they actually start by, you know, each accelerator program by teaching is entrepreneurship really for you. And they give some very, very, you know, scary examples in terms of why it's not for everybody. And then also from my perspective, just to add to all of the great things you said about founder evaluation, is following the digital breadcrumbs of the founders, like looking back at their early days, not mm-hmm. even just high school, but, you know, the college days, where I use that a lot, that analogy of, did you join the club or did you build a club? Kind of the whole concept of that's very famous, you know, the cartographer versus the navigator. Did you follow the map or did you actually create something for others to follow? So those are just some of the things, you know, exactly what you're talking about when it comes to looking at that FMF, that founder market fit in general.
Yeah.
The reason for me personally, angel investing is a lot more exciting than, you know, just being part of a venture fund or just mm-hmm. overall VC. Nothing against that, because there is purpose for that. But for me personally is to be able to partner with these founders, with these great teams, and really try to identify areas where I can be of genuine value beyond just financial support, because I've been there myself as a founder of like 4 companies, and it's very hard to find that right partner in the form of an investor who can really help you scale, grow, make the right introductions and so forth. From your perspective as that, I guess, as a syndicate or as a group of angels, mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit more about the whole concept of the value add investor and how do you guys treat that as such? Because there's that interesting dynamic between the founder community and the investor community. Yeah. Each side views that completely differently. And it's, I'm just curious to get your take on that.
Yeah. Okay. So a few thoughts here. Let me make sure I say them all. One is right now the market dynamics is that if you're an investor who's putting ridiculous terms, who's taking forever, who just comes in with a really haughty mentality, thinking that, you know, the founder owes you something, you are not going to get into, you'll get into deals, but I don't know that they'll be the right ones because it's just so competitive. There's more capital in the market than great deals. So, founders now, good founders can pick and choose who their investors are. So if you're listening to this and you're thinking about getting into angel investing or whatnot, it's really critical that you kind of understand those market dynamics. It's something that's different from years ago. That's why. And then the other piece of that is some advice also to founders that I always say is, do your due diligence on your investors because it's also critically important. You want to find the right partner and you should be able to have kind of, you know, it's not equally easy for everyone, but wait for the right one. It feels scary to turn down money. But if something is not resonating right, it is not worth it. Everyone always says it's like a marriage and all of that. And it largely is because it's a binding contract. And I have seen so many startups now just get stuck with the wrong investor and you can get blocked from doing it. It's the make or break for the company, to be completely honest. I really respect founders who do diligence on us. So ask us questions. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. Don't feel like you need to take whatever you get. And then so then your question on the investor side on value add, right? The way that we do things at Miami Angels is we look to strategically recruit the right membership base so that we can then get into the right deals. So at Miami Angels, as of right now, we're taking investors who work at tech startups or founders or invest in tech startups who kind of have a specific, they can be generalists. Generalists are really helpful as well, or people who have specific industry expertise. Because what we do is we, instead of just, hey, meet 100 angels, we say, hey, meet these two or three folks who we think can really be helpful for your company. Those members are the ones who lead the diligence for the rest of the group. If those members say that they're going to invest, only then do we bring it to the rest of the membership base. The rest of the membership base has great experience but may just not have the direct expertise for your company. So you're really working with a core set of people who end up, and we don't force this, but organically it happens often that the founder asks those members to become advisors or something like that. And I think the other real benefit of taking a Miami Angels investment is that you end up with a whole community of 100 plus 130 accredited investors who are then there to support you, who know about your company.
Right. Absolutely. No, I love the sound of that. And even when I was the founder raising capital for my startups, it was always very, you know, it seemed very unique in the sense working with the syndicates where you have multiple resources, multiple experts from different domain areas, you know, especially when they invest as a group. I think there's just so much to it where, you know, a lot of founders don't realize the value of that and be able to capitalize on a lot of the connections and expertise and things like that that the syndicate or the angel group actually offers. I think that's very interesting. And one thing that really, you know, stands out to me every time I meet with the founders and decide to invest is it's a long-term relationship. It's a minimum of 10 years being together. And it's the concept of being a friend to a founder versus being a parent. I think it's so important because if you try to guide and do, you know, prescribe things that are true to you, to the founders, it's probably a wrong relationship where you have to be kind of that person. When things go wrong, do you have that relationship to go grab a drink with the founder and talk about all the things that are not going well and how are we going to fix that particular problem. So I think that's just so important to have that dynamic with the founders.
Yeah, 100%. They have to feel like they can come to you. And going back to something I said earlier, the reason that we want founders who are open to feedback, and you touched on this as well, is not so that we can come in and tell you how to run the company. That's also a huge mistake that investors make, is fall in love with the product and not the team. That's wrong. Because you need to invest in the person. The product can change. And what we really want is that the person knows where, can ask for help and can see kind of their blind spots, because we all have them.
Mm-hmm. Right. Absolutely. No, you nailed that right on the head. And one of the things that really helps, at least me initially, when getting to know the founder, is without expressing any particular interest, I usually offer some type of help initially. Like, let me introduce you to that particular person. And just that, going through that exercise with the founder to see how they actually treat that introduction, how they follow up, how they act upon, usually tells a lot to me through those very simple steps where, you know, you'd be surprised how many times there's not even a follow-up with that particular introduction. So those are just some of the, you know, some of the steps to take, especially for those that are just starting out in this field from angel investing side or venture capital. As far as the deal flow, I want to talk a little bit about that with Miami Angels. Obviously, pretty established brand name, you know, here, at least in South Florida. What are the different strategies that you deploy that really help you build a quality deal flow? The reason I ask is because at times I try to categorize at least my deal flow from elite perspective. These are some of the ones that, you know, just super hot, super amazing deals. Then there's the standard ones. And then there's that flow that's, you know, you're not very familiar with, but at least you have some exposure to those type of startups. What's your approach to deal flow, and how do you go about building quality versus quantity?
Yeah, that's a great point. It is about quality versus quantity. It's about quality relationships and a little bit of seeing, not only talking to other investors who invest at the exact same stage as you, but those who invest before and after, because you're getting that up and downstream deal flow as well, and you being helpful to them. I try not to reach out to investors just saying, "Hey, seen anything lately?" It really needs to be a two-way street. It's just over time selecting kind of a core group of people that you work a little closer with. Before even all of that, the reputation is critical. So at the end of the day, your customers, your clients are founders, and it's important that any founder that comes into interaction with you or your company, that they have a good experience. And that means that most of the founders you're going to be saying no to, but that you're doing that also in a thoughtful way. At Miami Angels too, we try to do things differently. Like, our North Star is not to be a good angel group. We want to be one of the best investors there are. So that's touching venture funds as well. And that's why we've really flip the angel model on its head. We can close in, we say we're fast, friendly, and founder centric. So angel groups take 3 to 6 months to close. Sometimes we said we're going to close in 2 weeks to a month if we have to. We are willing to move our process to be flexible to founders, because we're here to invest in the right founders. So I would say that's like the first major component. And then the other stuff is really just tactical relationship building. That's not the complicated part.
Mm-hmm. Well, that makes sense. And kind of that speed to market, so to say, with ability to close fast, it's so instrumental, especially in the current market with lots of capital, you know, availability and, you know, actually shortage of the founders and the ideas that are, you know, worth investing. I think the ratio does not add up, and having that flexibility to move things faster in terms of actually getting access to a particular deal, I think that's how you succeed, especially in the current market and moving forward.
Exactly. It is an interesting market and asset class, and it's not for everyone. That's why we also know we're really specific on the type of investor that we want, because we have to be able to move really quickly.
Good deal. Rebecca, in the last portion of the podcast, I usually focus on some of the things that you utilize on a daily basis as a whole umbrella of content diet. What do you consume on a daily basis? What are your top sources for information and learning?
Yeah, great question. So on general news, I've really enjoyed a daily newsletter called The New Paper. It's what's the word I'm looking for? Not unbiased, but it's kind of more factual reporting, removes the left or right side. I just want the facts. So that one I really like, just to stay current on events, really quick and easy digest. Then for venture news, I used to have, you know, there's a lot of really good ones out there, but it just gets to be too much. So I've narrowed it down to one really, which is Term Sheet by Fortune. And then for my longer reads, which have been so helpful in just diving into industries or topic areas, I really like The Every. It's a syndicate of writers, actually. So they have like 10 or so writers. They talk a lot about, they do spotlights on startups, on different industries. It's a fantastic read. I love that one. And then I also, for just more general, kind of covers everything from finance to startups to pop culture, is The Profile, which is written by one of the writers from Term Sheet. She left to start her own publication, and it's fantastic.
Oh, those are great resources, and we'll make the links to those available in show notes. One thing to add that I recently discovered is the email newsletter that's put together by Matt Clifford. He's the founder of Entrepreneur First, and I think it's called Thoughts in Between. And I just thought that he's just, you know, I recently discovered that something within the lines of factual, mm-hmm. no fluff around that, and something that's really trending in the market for these particular reasons. So that's very cool. Yeah. And the last question I always ask is something that I actually love asking a lot of candidates that either I interview for my companies, or I help founders when they evaluate potential, you know, candidates to hire for their company.
Oh, I'm in the hot seat.
Yeah, you're in the hot seat. Is a question that goes, how do you think this conversation went?
Ah, well, I really liked it. It felt very not scripted. And as a podcast fan myself, I love the kind of shorter form like this. I think about 30 minutes is perfect. So it's gone super well.
That's awesome. Great. Rebecca, thanks so much for your time today. Very, very, very insightful conversation. Personally learned quite a bit. We'll stay in touch. We'll do another episode in about a year. See how much I've changed, transcribed.
Ah, that'd be great. Clock's ticking then.
Yeah, and we will revisit the conversation from last year and see, hey, here's what we talked about. Does that still make sense? Have we predicted the right thing? So I'm definitely looking forward to that.
Ah, that'd be great. Let's do it.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.